from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, award-winning author Roxane Gay joins us to talk about her new book, Difficult Women, a collection of short stories about women who are sometimes strong, sometimes vulnerable, and all finding their way through intense pain, loss, or impossible expectations. We'll also talk with Gay about her decision to pull her book from Simon & Schuster after they extended a book deal, now canceled, to Milo Yiannopoulos, and about writing black queer women into Marvel Comics. Join our conversation with Roxane Gay after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. We're joined this hour by award-winning author Roxane Gay, who's written a new collection of short stories titled Difficult Women. One story is about two inseparable sisters who were abducted together as children, another about a stripper putting herself through college, and another about a wealthy Florida-gated community where women compete with each other. Gay's previous books include An Untamed State and her New York Times bestselling essay collection, Bad Feminist. She's at work now on a comic book in Marvel's Black Panther series and a memoir. That is, when she's not blogging and tweeting her unique take on culture and politics or winning Scrabble tournaments. Roxane Gay, it's a pleasure to meet you. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind starting by reading something from the book. You have a passage there that you've selected in front of you from the title chapter, Difficult Women. Could you first set it up for us?
Sure. I wrote a story called Difficult Women, which is the title story, and it's a series of vignettes that really take up the tropes that women are often facing in terms of how they behave and move through the world. And so I'm going to read a part from A Crazy Woman. Why a Crazy Woman is Misunderstood. It started with a phone call after a third date where she followed him home and they had sex. Nothing memorable, but overall adequate. They had breakfast at the diner next door. He ate eggs, scrambled soft. She had pancakes doused in syrup and butter. "I can't believe you're a woman who eats," he said. "You're a dream." She smiled at him, the scent of maple heavy in her nose. When they said goodbye, they kissed long and hard, bruising their lips together. It was hours later, in her own apartment, when she remembered she left her briefcase on his couch. She called, and he didn't answer, and there were important papers and an iPad. She couldn't just let it go. She kept calling, and he kept not answering. He kept calling his best friend and saying, "This crazy woman is blowing up my phone." She went to his apartment, and when he answered the door, he said, "I've got mad skills." She rolled her eyes and said, "It wasn't that good," and pointed to her briefcase, exactly where she left it. His face reddened as she swept past him, grabbed her briefcase, and walked out, head held high.
That's Roxane Gay reading from her collection of short stories, Difficult Women. What was the inspiration, either specifically for that story, but for also writing a book called Difficult Women?
Well, I wrote these stories individually and then collected them, so there wasn't an inspiration necessarily in terms of writing a book. But with the title story, I was really interested in how women are often labeled frigid or difficult or crazy, and they're labeled these things for behaving in very normal ways. And a lot of times when a man and a woman go on a date, for example, and they have a good time, it's normal that you might want to contact that other person afterward. And sometimes men act like a call the next day is like, "Oh my God, she's completely crazy. What is going on? Why is she crowding me?" And it's really frustrating. And so I really wanted to just challenge a lot of that and a lot of the ways in which women are considered difficult just for existing.
And so how is it different from, say, your earlier book, Bad Feminist? I know that that was more personal essays, right, about you, but Bad Feminist, Difficult Women, I couldn't help but notice sort of the similarity, right, in terms of...
Well, I think it's because they come from the same writer. You know, I have, I think, an overall intellectual project which is deeply concerned with the lives of women and the range of women's experiences and challenging the status quo where women are concerned. And so you can definitely see a trajectory between the criticism in Bad Feminist and, of course, my fiction, because my intellectual project is very much the same. It's just the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
There was a chapter in Difficult Women that I was particularly struck by. It's called North Country, and it's about a black engineer. You know, she's in this very male-dominated field. She goes up to the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. Have you been to the UP?
Yes, I got my PhD up there.
So you know that area very well, and she has a very hard time being seen as a colleague by mm-hmm. the men in this world around her. And the other thing is she's from Nebraska, except she keeps being asked if she's from Detroit.
Yes.
I was wondering how much of your own personal experience was in that particular chapter, since you also are from Nebraska.
You know, I pull things from my life, but it's still fiction. And so when I was living in the UP, I was startled by how remote it was. I had never been there before. It's a completely different world, and it's 10 hours north of Detroit. And a lot of people don't even realize that that's still the United States, but it is. And so when I was living there, everyone kept asking me if I was from Detroit. And the first few weeks I was like, huh, why would they ask me that? And then I realized, of course, that as far as most people, especially in the Upper Peninsula, are concerned, all black people are from Detroit. That's the only center of blackness they know. And that intrigued me. And as I got to know the UP, I wanted to write basically a love letter to the place. And Michigan Tech, where I taught, is a predominantly male institution. And it was very interesting to be in a school that was 77% male. It's a very different experience.
Interesting how?
Just to see that environment and to see how women are treated in that environment, which is not to say it was a bad environment. It was just different. The dynamic on most college campuses is that there are more women than men, or it's a more equal balance. And here it was just where the boys are. And there were different dynamics in terms of, like, I would teach classes because I was a graduate student. I taught composition and technical writing. And you know, I would have classes with 22 boys and one girl. And it was just amazing to have that much testosterone in one room.
I think the other thing that struck me about that particular chapter was, while there were examples of, you know, men who were sexist or really pursuing the woman as basically a conquest for them, essentially, it was the story that I felt like had almost the sweetest male character
yes.
in all of the book.
Absolutely. You know, and a lot of the men in these stories are not good men, but that's fine. It's fiction. But I did, you know, I do have range. And so there are some stories with very good men in them, and North Country is one of them.
And the very good man in this book, though, it's not clear that if whether or not he will be a good man.
Oh, no, he's very good. He's great.
Initially, I mean.
Oh, yes.
As you're reading it.
Absolutely.
And that seems to be her struggle.
Correct. She's got some trust issues. And so she makes it really hard for him to get close to her. And I think that most people, regardless of gender, can relate to that. Those initial throes of a relationship where you find that you're attracted to someone and interested in them, but you don't know if you can let your guard down. And you don't know if you can trust that they won't hurt you in the ways you've been hurt before. And so a lot of the story is her grappling with that tension.
Have you had a lot of people assume you must have had a lot of negative experiences with men?
Oh, certainly. You know, a lot of people have taken some very interesting takeaways from this book. But, you know, it's male writers don't get the same pushback. Dennis Lehane writes a lot of very bad men. And nobody asks him about his bad experiences with men. And so I think it's frustrating that women are singularly judged for how they write men when we are not alone in writing about bad men, or bad women for that matter.
And you think this is because?
Sexism, of course, the patriarchy. You know, we could like talk about it all day. There's a range of reasons, but mostly I think it boils down to the rules are different for girls.
We're talking with author Roxane Gay. Her new book is Difficult Women, which is a collection of very intense short stories about women working their way through abuse or pain or impossible expectations. Her previous books include An Untamed State and Bad Feminist. I read that you like to write to the point of unreadability.
Yes, I do.
How do you decide where that point is?
I write to the point where I make myself nauseous. Where I feel like this is horrifying. And that's when I know I've found something true and something that will be indelible. And it's a difficult place to write to, and not everyone does it, and nor should everyone try. It's just that's what is interesting to me in terms of thinking through violence and trauma. I like to go explicit most of the time. Sometimes I'll write around it if it's if there's a good call for doing so. But in general, I like to look right into the eye of the storm.
Why shouldn't people do that?
It's really up to the writer. Every writer has different ways of writing about violence. And I think that each of those ways is legitimate. I just find that I don't want to sugarcoat it and I don't want to glamorize it. And so I want to write about the physicality of it and the emotional repercussions of it and how so much trauma just resides in the body. That's just something that very much intrigues me. And it's kind of an obsession, obviously, but that's just what is right for me.
And when you say right for you, what has it done for you to be able to write and work through that point?
Oh, it has just made me, it's allowed me to create stories that I'm very proud of and stories that feel very satisfying and true to what I'm trying to get at. I mean, and not even what I'm trying to get at, because when I'm writing fiction, I want to tell a good story. And so when I write something where I go to that place and then try and show how my characters go beyond that place, I find that very satisfying.
You decided to pull a book from Simon & Schuster that you were working on with them? Mm-hmm. Are you getting asked a lot about this, especially since Milo Yiannopoulos is in the news? Let me say a little more. Basically, Simon & Schuster extended a book deal to him, and he is a right-wing provocateur. They've since canceled that because of comments that he made that about pedophilia. And then you were asked if you would work again with this particular company. Can you talk a little bit about your thought process in terms of pulling the book and your response to those who are wondering if this changes anything for your relationship with Simon & Schuster?
Sure.
And you rolled your eyes. Is it because this is something you're getting asked a lot?
Yeah, because I haven't done any interviews about it because I didn't think it was a news story when I first pulled the book. I just knew that I could not in good conscience publish a book with a company that was willing to do business with Milo. Milo is so hateful. And I hate how he makes conservatism seem like it's grounded in hate and Islamophobia and transphobia and misogyny. That's not what conservatism is. And I feel like conservatives should be standing up and saying that a lot more, because if that's how you want to define your movement, then your movement has some real problems.
Yeah, you're worried they're seeding some very important ground
exactly.
to this particular message.
Really. And I think the repercussions, I don't think that conservatives are really thinking about the repercussions of who they're allowing to speak in their name. And so when I had to turn my book in January, as I was thinking about it and trying to find the time to just like wrap it up and get it ready to send to my editor, who is wonderful, I just couldn't do it. He stands for so much hatred, and it's the breathtaking scope of his harassment and what he allows his followers to do in his name that I find untenable and unacceptable. And so I decided to pull my book, and I will be paying back the advance because I can afford it, and B, I can sleep at night. And that's really important to me.
And how do you interpret Simon & Schuster's decision to now cancel that contract?
It was a business. Excuse me. It was a business decision. And that's fine because this is a business. But let's not pretend that they suddenly gained a conscience, because they were fine with everything terrible that Milo had said and done until these comments about pedophilia. And, you know, I actually have, I'm surprised by this, but a small amount of empathy for him, because he's clearly a survivor of trauma. And his comments, I think, were grounded in that trauma. Perhaps, I'm not even going to try and analyze him I don't know. That doesn't excuse anything he's ever done or said, but I am human enough to have some empathy for where those comments came from. You know, I do not think he's a pedophile in any way, and I think that's weird that people are saying that now. I think that this was the bridge too far, though, and I'm glad that we finally found where that is. But, you know, a lot of people have asked me if now I'm going to sort of run back to Simon and Schuster, and the answer is no. Well, first of all, it doesn't work like that. They don't want me back, I'm quite certain. But secondly, nothing has changed. I'm still very much in protest against everything that Milo stands for. And, you know, I think that when people say we have to hear all kinds of perspectives, I absolutely agree, but I don't think hatred is a perspective that's worth indulging and normalizing and enabling. And so, I'm going to take the book elsewhere.
We're talking with author Roxane Gay, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation if you have questions for Roxane Gay. The phone number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook or on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can also tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Roxane Gay's new book is called Difficult Women. Her other books include Bad Feminist, An Untamed State, and she's working on a comic book called World of Wakanda, which is part of the Black Panther series that she co-writes for Marvel Comics with Ta-Nehisi Coates. This particular comic book project I wanted to ask you about because I heard a couple of things in researching for this interview, that you are the first Black woman to write for Marvel?
I'm the first Black woman to lead a Marvel comic, yes.
To lead a Marvel comic. And you are writing about two women in World of Wakanda who are queer, who essentially have a relationship.
Yes.
What is Wakanda, first of all? And tell us about the decision to put this relationship into
yes.
that world.
Wakanda is the most technologically advanced nation in the world. It exists in the Marvel universe and in the hearts and minds of many of us. And World of Wakanda is a comic about the Dora Milaje, who are the elite all-women bodyguard unit for Black Panther, who is the leader of Wakanda. And so when Ta-Nehisi Coates emailed me and asked me if I would be interested in writing a comic book, I had no idea what he was talking about because this is not my world. And I had no idea what it would become. And I was really excited to be able to tell the story of two Black women and two Black queer women in the Marvel universe, because we are not represented in Marvel in general. At least historically. I think things are changing over there. They're doing a lot of really great work. So I'm excited to see what comes next. But it was just exciting to be able to write a love story about two Black women. And it's fraught, but it's a happy love story. And they find ways to be together despite some of the challenges that are in their way. And that's just – it was a lot of fun to write.
What adjustments, if any, have you had to make to your writing, your approach to writing, to make it for a comic book?
You know, I have found that storytelling is storytelling. So it's not that different. The challenges are, of course, understanding the Marvel Universe and continuity, which is very important at Marvel. And so you have to make sure that everything you're writing falls in line with everything else that Marvel is doing, especially in the Black Panther universe, because Ta-Nehisi is currently writing Black Panther. And so that's a challenge. And also just thinking about storytelling in terms of scenes. And because it's a visual medium that combines text as well, you have to think about how to get from one moment to the next.
You say that, you know, queer women are not represented in Marvel. They're not represented probably in a lot of writing.
Oh, yes. Let's not act like DC Comics is doing any better. Black queer women are not represented in any popular culture that we don't create ourselves. And, you know, this is a great opportunity, and we need to see more of that in mainstream popular culture. And also, it doesn't have to be mainstream, but I think that more visibility is in our best interest.
When they are written, how are they written?
How the comics?
No. Oh. Black queer women. What tends to be the way they're cast?
you know, I don't even know that we have stereotypes yet because we haven't been in the popular culture for long enough. But oftentimes, and we saw a lot of discussion about this last year, whenever queer women are depicted, oftentimes it's very tragic. The relationships are always one-sided, unrequited. Lesbians are often murdered or otherwise horrifically harmed. And it's incredibly frustrating that people see this as the only end result of lady loving. And I assure you, that's not the only option.
Well, Gretchen tweets, OMG Roxanne Gay, your speaking voice on KQED this morning. You rule. And Chris writes, I applaud your candor and courage of conviction. Looking forward to your new book. And let's hear from Elizabeth in Oakland. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm enjoying listening to you talk a lot. I'm a psychologist, and I have treated a lot of trauma. I've gotten sunk a little deep in trauma with a part-time job at the Veterans Administration. So I wanted to ask you about your I think the direction of my question is recovering from trauma, such as Milo, and I can't get his last name.
Yiannopoulos.
Has to do. You mentioned that he is clearly a victim of trauma who has come to a certain point of integrating that, and a very unfortunate place of integrating that. And I just wanted to ask you about, recovering from trauma, writing explicitly about violence, and in the process of possibly recovering from it, if you have any thoughts about that. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Recovery from trauma through writing, potentially? I think that's what I'm understanding.
I think so. Yes, I think writing can help in terms of, especially when I was much younger, I would just write the same horrific things over and over again. And back then, they weren't good. It was just clearly cathartic. And I didn't share that work with anyone. I just wrote it. And I found that to be very helpful. At this point in my life, at this age and the many years of therapy I've had, now I just write as a storyteller. But I do think that there's a lot of value to writing out your truth, particularly for those of us who at the time of our trauma were unable to articulate it in any other way. For me, words were all I had because I couldn't talk to my family and
my friends.
You're talking
about your sexual assault when you were very young, yes.
There was no way I could have possibly had that conversation at 12 years old. I was too young and too sheltered and too scared. But I could write and I didn't have to show it to anyone. And sometimes I would just write and then I would throw it away. Because I would write, by hand or use my typewriter. And that was really freeing just to have that when I didn't have anything else.
We'll have more with Roxanne Gay, author of the new book, Difficult Women, also author of An Untamed State and the New York Times bestselling essay collection, Bad Feminist. We'll have more with her after the break. You can join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email your questions to forum at kqed.org, post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. More after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. We're talking with novelist, essayist, commentator, professor Roxanne Gay. She's the author of An Untamed State, an essay collection called Bad Feminist, other short stories. She blogs, she tweets, and her new short story collection is Difficult Women. And we have listeners calling in and one listener tweeting, thank you, Ms. Gay, for speaking out about Simon & Schuster and money-making versus ethics of conscience. Right on. And W-R-I-T-E is how she says right on, or he. Kevin writes, Ms. Gay, you should have followed Chris Rock's example, not Jada Pinkett Smith's. You're not helping anyone by refusing to get your money. Don't worry about Milo. He's making his money with no apologies. Do you want to respond to that?
I absolutely do. I've been offered 10 times the money I was getting from Simon & Schuster. So trust me, I always get paid.
Earlier before the break, we were talking about trauma, and I wanted to ask you about your relationship to forgiveness and acceptance. The reason I say this is because you've written that you find that people feel this is the way to recovery of trauma, mm-hmm. but that you aren't necessarily so sure. And I was wondering if that's true and if you could explain why.
Wait, that what isn't the way to trauma?
Forgiveness and acceptance is not necessarily the answer to recovery. You feel like we as a culture kind of put those things up.
Yes,
there
I do. I think we revere this idea of forgiveness. And I get why, because it's such a seductive thing and it's a beautiful thing when you can actually forgive someone. I'm just not capable of such beauty. I can't do it. And I mean, I can, but not in all instances. I do believe some things are unforgivable, and I do believe I can move on and be set free from whatever without forgiveness. For me, it is not a necessary part of my process. And allowing myself that gave me so much freedom, because I read so many books and heard so often in therapy that you have to forgive in order to really let go. And no, I surely don't. And I think it's important to let people know that that is also an option, that you do not have to forgive the people who have wronged you.
Let's hear from our listeners. Let's hear from Lynn in San Francisco. Hi, Lynn. Hi, Lynn.
Do you mean Gwen?
Oh, Gwen. Yeah, sorry. The name was written here as Lynn. It was probably just a typo.
You know, I loved her remark about people thought she was from Detroit just because she's black. I live in San Francisco. I've been here 30 years. And, you know, I'd go to school. Where did they get you? Oakland. And they would say it really sarcastic. And not all black people live in Oakland. And right now, I couldn't afford to live in Oakland if I wanted to. My other comment was about strong black women. And it's not, I'm just picking up on the fact that we seem to intimidate white, straight, heterosexual males and gay males. And I don't know what that's about. Or, you know, they tend to treat us, you know, like we're sassafras. And I get that more than, you know, I'd expect black men to think we're castrating or whatever. But it's just, you know, I'm beginning to pick up on that from white males, too.
Lynn, thanks for sharing that point. Do you have any thoughts on that, Roxanne Gay?
No, I don't. But thank you, Gwen.
Gwen, I mean. Sorry. Again, it was written here incorrectly. Alex in Richmond.
Hi, Roxanne. I saw you yesterday at City Arts and Lectures. You were incredible.
Oh, thank you.
I have been reading a lot about intersectional feminism lately. I was once called out for my feminism not being intersectional enough. And that was really important for me. But I see a lot of white allies, and I understand that's a vexed word, not reacting well to being called out. And I'm wondering if you know, you're so empathetic, if you have a sense for what the best strategy might be for bringing more mainstream feminists into the intersectional feminism tent.
Yes, I think that many people, when they're called out, myself included, aren't going to initially react well. It's what you do next. And so it's okay to react badly. Nobody likes to be criticized. There's nothing really pleasant about that. But I do think that more people need to just get over themselves and realize that maybe we don't have all the answers and maybe we can be more inclusive and have productive conversations about material ways in which that inclusion can be brought about. And so I do have empathy for people who bristle at being told they're not being intersectional enough. At the same time, I also think, okay, you've had your feelings. And now let's move forward and let's do something.
Alex, thanks for the question. Do you want to explain what intersectional means?
Yes, intersectional is a terrible word. It is, first of all, it's too many syllables. But, you know, it's a great word, too. Intersectional feminism is simply this idea that we must recognize that as women, we are not only women. We have a multiplicity of identities. We have gender identity. We have race or ethnicity. We have faith backgrounds, ability, class background, sexuality, and all of these identity markers affect us. And so not all women are created equal, and we need to be able to recognize that and recognize that we can't just fight for women and assume that all of our concerns are the same.
It feels like identity markers, identity politics is being stigmatized quite a bit these days.
It really is, and it's very interesting because people just throw out the phrase identity politics as if that's a means of stopping all conversation. But, you know, we have identities, and it's okay to embrace those identities and to talk about how our identity shapes us and affects how we move through the world. And so the phrase identity politics is in many ways diminishing and frustrating because, you know, this is our lives that we're talking about. Don't be so dismissive of it.
Well, Kelly in Oakland, join us.
Hi, Roxanne. I loved your book, Bad Feminist. I'm very interested in the cross-generational view of feminism, of how younger people work in San Francisco, and obviously there's a lot of tech in the city, and talk about maybe the equality of women in the workplace and in the technology fields, lacking equality. I just wondered what you thought about, I'm a woman in my 50s, and I think back on the groundbreaking women in feminism that helped inform my political views. And I just wondered if you had any generalized comments about how younger women versus boomers, maybe in your experience as a teacher, are viewing feminism or acting out and promoting feminism in the workplace and within their communities.
How they have it easier, did you say?
I don't think they have it easier. I just wondered if you noticed a difference, mm-hmm. or you know where we might converge with these generational differences mm-hmm. in our regards about feminism.
Yes, absolutely. I do think that there are generational splits in terms of how women view feminism. A lot of younger women seem to think we don't need it anymore, that the work is done. And that's interesting because such is not necessarily the case. But I also see a lot of young women who are really energized and who are wanting to capture some of the energy of feminism in the 70s, for example, and do something now to, for example, as you note, create more gender equity and parity in the workplace and make sure that our reproductive freedom remains intact, particularly under this new administration. And so, what I don't see is a lot of cross-generational conversations. I see people within their cohorts having conversations, but we're not doing a lot of talking to each other, and I don't know how to bridge that gap. But I think we do need to find a way, because I think there's a lot that each generation can learn from one another, and that a lot of productive work can happen across the generations.
Well, let me thank Kelly for the call. Rachel tweets, have you heard who the new Bachelorette is going to be? If so, what are your thoughts? This tweet also... I'd like you to answer that question, but it reminds me, too, of something that I think you've written about a lot, which is, and maybe this is really what Bad Feminist was all about, but that you enjoy things that may not necessarily be challenging the status quo around mm-hmm. sexism, music that may have misogynist lyrics to it, things like that. So how do you reconcile that?
I do love The Bachelor. Or I hate it. It depends on the season. I hate this season of The Bachelor, but I'm very thrilled about Rachel, who's going to be the next Bachelorette and who's going to be the first Black Bachelorette. I think it's so, so important that we have a Black Bachelorette because culturally, Black women are rarely represented as objects of desire. And of course, objectification is not ideal. It's not good in any way, but... last Sunday at the Grammys, Adele, who I love, got on stage and said that she wants Beyonce, who is the sexiest woman alive, to be her mommy. And then Faith Hill, who is old enough to be Beyonce's mother, said, oh, I want you to be my mommy, too. And that the sexiest woman on the planet Earth, who was wearing a sheer outfit, was told that she was maternal. It was absurd. And I think it just reinforces this need for Black women to be seen in popular culture as other things. And we're seeing that more and more. But The Bachelorette being Black is going to be wonderful. And also, it's going to be terrible. I can't wait to see the pharmaceutical representatives and trainers that they parade in front of her.
Well, Chin writes, I'd love to hear Roxanne's advice on balancing self-care and emotional labor and explaining to others and clapping back.
Mm-hmm. You know, I often tell people that if you want to learn from me, enroll at Purdue, where I teach, because I can only teach so much. And so you really do have to create boundaries for yourself as to how you're going to teach, when you're going to teach, and why. Increasingly, I only try to do that sort of emotional labor when I think something fruitful is actually going to be born of it. Other than that, it's not my job. I clap back on Twitter just to release frustration. It's so relaxing and refreshing to do. And that sounds weird, but so many people get in my face all day and they say the cruelest things to me. And so sometimes I just need to say something cruel, not even cruel. I don't think I'm cruel, but I do need to say something sharp right back and put them in their place, which is to say, you know, treat me like a person because I am indeed a person. I am not just a few blips on a screen.
And let's hear from Bob in Oakland. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Roxanne. I'm such a fan of yours. I have a related question, I suppose. You're surrounded by these assaults on your very identity, and we see so much aggravating, terrible, hateful news all the time. How do you sound so calm? Like, how are you so stable? I really admire that, and thank you. I would love any tips. Thank you.
Yes. You know, I don't know how. I think part of it is that I'm a Libra, and so I'm always interested in balance. I think part of it is that I have someone in my life that is a place of solace for me and a place where I can just be myself. And I think part of it is that it's important and radical even to find joy in difficult times, to say that, to recognize how terrible things are, but that we still have a right to joy and we still have a right to freedom. And so I especially since November 8th, I have just been working very hard to not get bogged down in a morass of despair, because it's all very despairing, but I can't surrender to it.
You have said that on November 8th that you went from feeling stunned to being ashamed of being stunned. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by being ashamed of being stunned?
I really thought better of the United States. I really, really did. And in some ways I was right, because Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. And she is my president. But I really underestimated misogyny and, more importantly, racism. I underestimated Trump for sure, but he underestimated himself. He didn't think he was going to win. And we can see from his first 34 days in office that he was completely unprepared and he is not up to the task. And so I'm stunned. I'm ashamed. I should have known better. I should have been more vigilant. I feel like I should have done more. I didn't write about Hillary. I wanted to, but I never quite did, because, you know, I write for the New York Times and I love it, but the level of feedback I get is really overwhelming and it's often very hateful. And so I just knew that if I wrote about Hillary Clinton, I was going to be inundated, and I just didn't have the energy for it. And I look back now and I know I would not have changed the outcome of the election, because that's not in my power. I'm just a random writer. But I do feel like I should have been more vocal of my support.
Then are you starting to view yourself or take your work on in more of an activist type of way?
I wouldn't call myself an activist, though many people call me an activist.
Yes, I've noticed that.
But yes, absolutely. We cannot be passive. And so the opposite of passivity is activity. And yes, I am thinking of myself increasingly as an activist.
Well, Robert asks, similar to what we're talking about, he says, as a writer, did you set out to become such a dominant voice for feminist issues, or would you prefer to be thought of simply as a writer?
You know, I don't have any control over how I'm thought of, so I accept that. I never in my life imagined that I would emerge as a dominant voice about feminism. I really, you know, I wrote a few essays, and feminism informs everything I do. So I never imagined that it would become this thing. And in fact, calling the book Bad Feminist, it was originally called What We Hunger For. And my editor and I were talking and she was like, too many words. And I was like, that's four. And so I got it down to two with Bad Feminist because that was one of the essays. And it also was very catchy. And I thought, this is great. And I didn't really imagine it would take on a life of its own. And yet it took on a life of its own. And here we are. And so I don't shun the labels that people give me because I know that they come from a place of respect. And I appreciate that. But I never imagined this. Certainly, I want to be seen as a writer. I am a writer. And, you know, when you're called, oftentimes, you know, your work gets put on lists. The 10 greatest books coming out from Black women this year. And I want to be on a list of the 10 greatest books coming out from writers this year. I don't mind being on that other list, but I'm not just my identity. And my writing is not strictly born of my identity. Sorry, there's a little pun in there. I laugh at my own jokes. It's super uncomfortable. But yeah.
Well, Todd writes, while I have sympathy for the unfair burdens that women face, does Roxane Gay recognize the extraordinary burdens that men also face? As a man in my 30s, I've faced exceptional stress living up to the societal standard of being the financial leader of our families. I've seen peers have mental breakdowns or lose their spirit altogether. Also, does Gay have any comment on the buffoonish way that straight white men are depicted in popular culture?
Oh, bless his heart. Bless his heart. You know, I do think that men are as burdened by gender expectations as women. I absolutely do. But the societal repercussions are so different. There is absolutely no comparison. And I am not going to cry for the straight white man's burden. I really am not. But I do think it's hard for anyone to be the head of household. It is absolutely difficult to, especially in a city like this, especially in an area like the Bay Area. This place is unsustainable for most of us. I could never in my life afford to live here. And so I do have empathy for that. I do have empathy for the pressures of masculinity. But, you know, the buffoonery of how straight men are depicted, it rises out of truth. You know, all stereotypes start somewhere.
But there's also just a lot more variation in the
there is. There's so much range.
So, yes, there are buffoonish men.
There are.
There are also lots of others.
For every sitcom dad, there are these amazing and nuanced male characters on HBO dramas. Women get one opportunity. Oftentimes, we're the wife. We're the girlfriend. There's a reason the Bechdel test in movies exists, because when there are two women in a movie or a television show, they're generally talking about a man. And so it's very narrow to only see this sort of idea of the white man's burden and to not recognize you have the world as your oyster. And so get some, you know, if you see people having breakdowns, it means that we have to talk about mental health and men being able to access mental health.
Lauren's in Mountain View. Good morning.
Good morning. Ms. Gay, thank you so much. It's been a revelation and a fascinating experience listening to you, and I'm new to your work. I'm looking forward to getting better acquainted with it. My question is just this. When male writers essay the creation of female characters, do you have any suggestions for them? I mean, broadly speaking, is it best to just pretend as though female characters, characters in general, have no gender at all, to a zeroth approximation, and to regard the influence of gender on character as a kind of a minor effect, mostly negligible, and then gradually work up from there? Are there concrete specific things that you think are helpful for male writers to do to develop greater empathy and sophistication in their appreciation of the challenges that are involved in that? And how do you feel about this sort of striking phenomenon with people like Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock deciding that if they're actually going to have interesting roles, they're going to have to take them from screenplays in which those roles were conceived by the authors of those screenplays for men? It's sort of a startling and impressive phenomenon to me.
Lauren, thanks.
Yes, there are lots of things that men can do to write women more effectively. I don't think you need to start from this place of genderless identity and then sort of like build women's attributes on top of that. I think that, and I tell this to my students when we talk about writing across difference, you have to focus on character, not caricature. You have to shy away from stereotypes. You have to recognize that women are not all the same. And so she has to be an individual and she has to have a personality and she can't have singular interests in domesticity or shopping, for example. It's just a question of practice makes perfect. And I think it's important to at least try. And I think when you try in good faith, your readers are going to follow you, even if you make a few stumbles. Certainly I can look at some of my writing and think, okay, you know, my male characters were a bit singular and I need to get more nuanced. And the more mature I get as a writer, the more I try to bring more nuance to my male characters.
I read that you felt like you could write male characters sometimes, not necessarily the most glowing ways because you have a wonderful father.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I, you know, a lot of times people ask me if I hate men and the answer is absolutely not. But I do hate the ways in which men maintain the status quo and don't step up and fight for women in the ways that they should. But I have wonderful father, wonderful brothers, you know, I have male friends.
One of your upcoming books is a memoir called Hunger. And it's, I read that the process of this coming out is you've described it as terrifying mm-hmm. at times.
Yes.
Tell us about Hunger.
So Hunger is coming out on June 13th, and it is a memoir of my body. It's a book about trauma and obesity, and it was the most difficult thing I've ever written. It was not fun, and I love writing. It's always fun. And so for this to be not fun made it just a real slog, and so it ended up being delayed a year because of that. I just kept pushing it off, and also I was on the road, and I just never really wanted to write it. And that is what let me know that I was on to something and that this was a book that I needed to write. When you live in an overweight body, people project all sorts of things onto your body. They already have a preconceived notion of who I am based on how I look. And so I was trying to reinscribe that narrative with my own words and my own experiences in this book. People are going to still project and make assumptions and be cruel and all of that, but I still have the right to tell the story of my body in my words. And so that's what I'm doing with Hunger.
How long have you worked on this?
It's been 2 years. Yes. And
you mean I'm in terms of conceiving of writing something about this has been
two years.
Yeah.
The book came to me after Bad Feminist was published and I had learned how to cook late in life and I was a vegetarian living in rural America. And so that can be challenging at a restaurant in a town where like the restaurants think vegetarian is iceberg lettuce and some French fries. And so I started cooking for myself and writing a blog, writing blog posts about cooking. And so the book rose out of that and just thinking about my body and how did I get to this place and thinking about how I have a right to nourish myself, because oftentimes you think, oh, I'm fat, I shouldn't be eating. But you do need to eat to live. And so the book just started to come together then.
Well, Mary writes, this discussion is so timely for me. I'm a 62-year-old woman writing about my experience with sexual assault that lasted over 20 years.
Oh, dear.
From assault as a child to date rape as a teenager to getting involved with prostitution as a young woman. Prostitution saved my life, put me in control of my body and the men who wanted it, and allowed me to move on to years of therapy. I'm very grateful to hear this interview and look forward to reading your works.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you so much. And I'm glad that you're writing about your work, about your life, rather.
Megan writes, I want to give you a shout out for displaying real courage. Journalists in this day and age are getting all the credit for being courageous in the face of Donald Trump with his minions. But you prove that fiction writers can and should be brave as well. Bravo.
Thank you.
And let's try to squeeze in one last call from Dan in San Francisco. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. So I'd like to return to the concept of identity politics. I mean, I think you gave a very good defense of you know, why identity is important. But I'm wondering about on the political side of things, How do you think identity figures constructively in politics? I mean, I guess politics being the space ideally where we have equal rights regardless of our identities. And you mentioned, you know, I'm not only my identity. So, I wonder if you have thoughts on that.
Well, we have not yet gotten to a place where people of different identities have equal rights. And so until we get to that place, identity is going to factor very heavily in politics. And, you know, I think that we have to, again, we have to be intersectional in the political arena and recognize that not all Americans are created equal. One of the overriding narratives that came out of November 2016 was that there were a lot of white Americans who were disenfranchised and who were feeling alienated, and that we have to somehow understand them to win over their votes. And I would suggest that that understanding needs to go in all directions, that there are people struggling everywhere, and that economic anxiety is not really what was at stake in 2016, though it was part of it. And so we just have to continue to be mindful of how identity plays in the political arena and how politicians can more effectively reach a broader range of constituents.
We're almost out of time. I wonder if there's a project that you, a dream project for you.
Honestly, I'm working on my dream project, but I can't talk about it.
Ooh. Roxane Gay, novelist, essayist, commentator, professor, and author. Her new book is Difficult Women. And she's working on a comic book on Marvel's Black Panther series. And her new memoir coming out soon is Hunger. I hope you'll come back when that comes out.
I will.
Thank you, Roxane Gay. And thank you to our listeners for your questions. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer is Howard Gelman today. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our interns are Stephanie Roberts and Devin Holt. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and Holly Kernan is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.